Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Forecast is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This episode of Forecast is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account for 6 months, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code FORECAST8. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to Netflix.com/TWiT.
What sort of future do you think we're heading for? How will we live as we slip into the 21st century?
Welcome to Forecast, episode 86. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Scott Johnson.
And this is the show where we invite two smart people to join us every week and give us their visions of the future while Scott and I sit here slack-jawed going, wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what
We get smart people on here.
Yeah.
They come in and they kind of blow our minds, and I don't think today will be any different.
We got a couple of great guests happy to have along with us this week. Teresa Ellis, digital marketing and PR for Fleischmann Hillard, and the communication nerd. Nice to see you again, Teresa.
Hey, how's it going?
Good to see you. I got to know Teresa up at PAB, Podcasters Across Borders in Ottawa. So thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to be here.
And Fraser Ntakula, animator and motion designer in Birmingham, United Kingdom, and the designer of one of my wife's favorite T-shirts.
Hello.
Welcome to the show.
That's a great honor.
It's good to have you along. Can't wait to hear you guys' predictions. Scott, but as usual, we're going to start with a listener prediction.
Always with an email. And we get these at forecastpodcast.com, don't we, Tom?
Forecastpodcast@gmail.com or on the website, like he said, forecastpodcast.com. This one comes from Nathan in Atlanta. He says, I was thinking about the rising cost of food as well as the issue of CO2 emissions. My thought is that humanity will figure out how to modify and combine plant DNA to our own. We will then have the ability to absorb all the nutrients and chemicals we need directly from the earth and our surroundings. We will have specialized cells capable of producing energy in a similar way to photosynthesis. Just like plants, we too will take in CO2 and breathe out oxygen, thus helping to counterbalance CO2 emissions. However, we will eventually have the opposite problem we have now, and there will be too much oxygen and not enough CO2 in the atmosphere. But we can cross that bridge when we come to that. I've never had anyone write into the show and suggest we're going to become plants.
No, and also, one problem with this prediction is I fear the super vegetarians that will come and eat the people that come from this. But the idea that we're all going to be plant-based, basically, isn't a terrible idea. I feel like that's maybe a solution, or at least a idea, be it a bit of a crazy-ass one, but it's an idea on how to deal with our energy crisis and how we consume things. I think that's not bad.
Teresa, would you go for the plant surgery that allowed you to breathe in CO2?
I'm not sure. I now that you bring up the vegetarian thing, I am a little concerned.
Yeah, nobody wants to be in the next salad.
No, they don't. Yeah. Fraser, how do you feel about the future of man, plant, and our eventual union, according to this reader?
That's almost like a flip of, kind of life in itself. I mean, are we going to have, what are the plant, like meat-eating plants going to turn into then? Are they going to start eating, are they going
like to switch to them?
Yeah. What's going to happen to them?
Yeah. Well, we have to have giant bees go from person to person to get our, to sort of impregnate one another. How's that all going to go?
Yeah, it's getting confusing now.
Yeah, porn's going to look really weird.
Oh, yeah.
The cool thing about this prediction, in all seriousness, is the idea of being able to take that sort of idea of photosynthesis and incorporate that so that we don't have to eat. I don't think we'll ever breathe in CO2 and breathe out oxygen necessarily, but some sort of genetic modification that allowed us to produce our own energy so that we don't have to produce as much food.
Yeah, and I wonder if there's a way. Does it have to be plant-based? Can we come up with other ways to produce our own energy? Could we become genetically altered so that we're solar creatures? And I guess that's essentially what a plant is doing.
Yeah, but yeah. It doesn't necessarily have to be chlorophyll that does it, though. You're right.
Yeah, because the picture I have is that we've got leaves, and now we're like swamp people, and I can't get that out of my head. And I'm not saying that that's definitely a side effect of this, but there will be side effects. The reason things are green have to do with photosynthesis and the kind of, you know... the word just left me. I knew it in science. Don't know it now. But all these kinds of things that plants need to do, we don't necessarily want to dig. You know, we don't want to plant our feet in earth all day and, you know, soak in nutrients that way. There are a lot of things plants do besides, you know, process sunlight. So I think we have to refine that down to whatever the basis can be for us to be relatively human still, but have some new source of energy to at least augment, if not replace, our, you know, existing need for food.
Teresa or Fraser, either one, what do you think of this idea of incorporating energy-producing cells within us? Is that likely?
You know, it might happen. There could be a way for us to, you know, the idea that as we move, you know, we create energy, and maybe that could be somehow recycled into us, sort of kinetic energy. You know, you never know. Something like that could work.
Yeah, we could just recapture our own motion.
I mean, if we could somehow maybe have some sort of leaves hanging out from our body parts or something that absorb light, and we could still be humans, but with some weird additions, you know, genetically modified to, you know, absorb oxygen and stuff like that. So
just fashion, who knows? Make a fashion statement out of it. You know, make it so it looks good. That leaf hanging off my back is not, you know, a problem. It's a fashion statement, Tom.
No, this. Exactly. You know, this is it actually helps the environment as well. So, you know,
it gives a whole new meaning to the new fall fashions.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Let's get into our short term predictions. These are things you think will happen sooner rather than later, maybe in the next few years. And Teresa, we'll start with you. What do you got for us?
Okay, so my first prediction, I was thinking about how the advent of technology has been sort of creating fewer opportunities for people to practice their handwriting, because you're always typing and you're always like, you know, sending messages via your keyboard or something like that. So I was thinking that this might lead to an eventual breakdown of handwriting, and then eventually, more specifically, the disappearance of the signature completely for like documents and things. I think we can sort of move towards like fingerprinting or some kind of biotech identification where we won't have to actually write anything anymore, and it'll just be all through your body.
That's interesting, Teresa, because today I signed for a package from the UPS guy, and my signature was less of a signature and more of a smear. And really, it did not. There was no telling who just signed that. And they always ask you for your name, so they don't even believe you, even if you do a good signature on that machine. I've wondered for a long time why we still care about signatures. But on the other side, I do know, or at least I think I know, why we care about handwriting. I have this fear that permeates through all forecast episodes, keeps coming up now and again, that there'll come a day when we have gotten so locked in digitally and we've stored everything in virtual space that doesn't really exist if a calamity big enough destroys it all. We're not going to have much in the way of records that you know, show language, that show writing, that show styles of writing. I mean, cursive alone is already, you know, this antiquated thing. And I've got kids now who type most of the time, whereas when I was their age, I wrote most of the time. But, you know, since maybe age 17 or so, I haven't done much other than type for most of the time. So, yeah, we're typing on paper sometimes. Sure, we're printing stuff out. But I feel like this is, you know, if you could go back in time and find a lost civilization, the losing of their language and or their ability to communicate their history probably ran into similar problems. I'm not saying it was digital, but, you know, they didn't expect something to happen that did, that wiped out everything they had, all of their records.
Like the burning of the library at Alexandria?
Kind of that idea, except in this case, we're talking about bits and bytes that could just be wiped out in a second. And maybe there's so much of it that we're not worried, but it does concern me. So, Teresa, how do you respond to that? What do the nations of the world today do to preserve, you know, French and English and these languages in all of their forms, especially if we're not writing them and keeping journals, you know, by hand anymore?
Gosh, I don't actually know. I think that my concern is similar to yours, and thinking about just what Tom mentioned, the disappearance of like whole volumes of history because they were written down and there was no oral passing down of the story. So maybe it comes down to really just an oral tradition and reviving the oral tradition that used to exist so strongly in, you know, Aboriginal cultures and is sort of dying out on its own there. But maybe we should focus on telling stories and making sure that we're passing down the knowledge that we need from one generation to the next verbally.
In some ways, that's kind of what we're doing now, because we don't print as much, and it's reducing. Finally, there was actually a spike in printing for a while. Paperless office was sort of a joke, but we really have moved past printing a lot of things, and we're going into this sort of, it's not oral history exactly, but social networking and everything is kind of has the same pattern as oral history. Even though it's written, it's kind of transient, and you're passing along your story to multiple people and kind of getting it out there.
Yeah.
All right.
Teresa, I was going to ask you, so you're a communications nut. So this seems like it fits right in with not only your prediction, but with your sort of your general line of thinking. When is it too late for us to figure out that we have to buckle down and, I don't know, employ more traditional forms of communication? Or do we at all? Is this fear of mine even based on anything? Are we okay to just keep doing it the way we're doing it? And if not, you know, how likely is it that we're going to lose our ability to communicate in the future?
I don't know if it's, I think we're probably doing okay. I think, like Tom said, the advent of social networking and sharing with more people has protected us. It sort of adds a layer of protection, because now, you know, if things disappeared, well, you've probably told that story to someone else and you've talked about it with other people, and that knowledge is out there in the world. I think, though, it is a concern that one day, you know, a giant magnet falls on planet Earth and everything gets deleted.
Right.
What happens then?
You don't want all your eggs in one basket. Fraser, do you fear that eventually, if we lose the ability to write, to hand write, that we risk losing the ability to communicate effectively?
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame, because I think maybe our cave paintings are going to be CDs. You know, that's what the legacy we're leaving, some digital format which won't be easily accessible to anyone kind of digging for the past. That's going to be a bit of a difficult kind of thing to kind of carry over to the future generation, especially if something comes over and wipes it all out. So, yeah, that is a big concern, and I don't really know how we could fix that unless we print everything, you know, from the internet, which is, again, too much information or...
That can burn.
Yeah, it sure can.
And that can be, a
tiny little piece of me wants all this to fall apart so that there is somebody 1,000 years from now who've built back up some society from the rubble, and now they have no idea what we were doing, but they're digging 3 or 4 layers down in the crust of what was left from the aftermath, and they're finding weird iPhones and Android phones and strange video game consoles and controllers and weird technology that they had no idea, you know, was around, or they don't know what the use is. And then I want to see them try to explain it and try to figure out what this ancient people did, you know, with a curling iron or something, and figure out what that's all about. I would love to be able to witness that at some point.
It'd be fun to put it together, wouldn't it? Piece it together. What's this all about?
The gods of these people were round and mirrored with holes in the middle. They worshipped mandala symbols.
Exactly.
All right, Fraser, let's move it over to you for your short-term prediction, something you think happens sooner rather than later. What do you got for us?
All right, I think in the next couple, next generation or so, privacy, as we know it, will kind of disappear. You know, you see kind of on the internet now, we have facial recognition and everyone's kind of trying to hold on to that grasp. But the kids today don't really...
We won't
be
able to write secret
lives.
Notes anyway because of the handwriting. So,
that's gone. Yeah, it's out of the window. The kids today are growing up with phones and internet, and they don't really have the same concerns we have of kind of protecting that, you know, exposure out there. So I think it's just the whole privacy factor will just vanish.
Wow. So, Fraser, here's a question for you. This comes up on the show all the time. We're going to lose our ability to have any kind of privacy anymore. And sometimes I just say, fine, whatever, I'm ready, let's go. And other times I kind of go, maybe not so much. Let's slow this train down. What are the negative impacts of this? Like, what if someone just said to you, I'll say it now, Fraser, what if this happens and you lose your ability to have any privacy? What are the ramifications? What's bad about that?
It basically makes sure that you have to be responsible for everything you say and put out there. There's no kind of code names or hidden pathways you can take. You know, your IP address is already exposed at this stage. So when people have that and your photos and your address and everything else, you pretty much, your identity exists out there. So you have to just be responsible. You have to take care of your identity on there, on the internet. So that is quite a daunting thing if you want to do something dodgy, whatever that might be. You know?
True, but if everybody, see, this is what the point I wanted to get to, is if everybody's got that same level of privacy or that same lack of privacy, doesn't that level the playing field and make it so it doesn't really matter? Like, for example, sure, you could flub up and say something you didn't mean to say and then go delete it, but people saw it, so now they know you said it. But that's going to be true everywhere. Like, everybody will be under those same sort of restrictions. So does that make it any better, or does that make it actually worse? What do you think?
It might result in a change in culture and society. Maybe some of those things won't be viewed as negative anymore. You know, like you said, if people are on the same playing field, we might just be, fine, he's that guy, he's done that, and he said that, but we're not going to judge him or we have no problems. That's kind of one outcome. Or it could just kind of flip in the other direction where, I don't know, everyone just gets rounded up for saying even the most minuscule thing, you know, so because the authorities are clamoring down on Twitter kind of lately, you know, you can't have any injunctions or anything like that. So there's so many cases where they're trying to get information. So, you know, it could go either way.
Well, the standards of privacy have changed over time, and they even change from place to place on the planet. So in some sense, it's really just about redefining what we think is important to be private and what not. And we're in the process of technology forcing us to change that, because some things that used to be hideable just by accident are too easily discovered now. We have to adjust. Teresa, are you worried? Does this worry you, or do you think we'll come to some sort of equilibrium?
I think we'll probably reach some kind of equilibrium, mostly because, like you said, it's forcing us to, basically, the way privacy is moving is forcing us to choose what exactly we think of and what we need to be private versus what's kind of okay. And I think it's different for different generations, of course. Like, for example, my dad will never be on Facebook because he just doesn't think that that's a good idea. But you know, I think now we're being forced to really decide, you know, when I'm outside in what feels like I'm alone, I'm possibly not alone and someone's watching me, and that can be a safety feature. It can also be a privacy invasion. So we need to sort of decide as a culture and figure out what's important to us.
Well, so here we are living on an age where Tom and I and you two, we're all sitting around talking, and we may say something. I may say something that, I don't know, and let's say in 8 years is suddenly offensive. Right now it isn't, but for whatever reason, sensitivities change, and in 8 years they hear me say this thing in some archive of this show. How responsible should I be for that? See, that's the part that scares me. I'm not so scared about the current level of privacy or loss of privacy. It's the taking stuff out of context, whether it be context of time or context of conversation or whatever, taking that out and using that against somebody years from now. Or even months from now, or even right now. It seems like if we're going to be this much more open, society's going to have to be this much more ready to be accepting of opinions, to be less reactionary about something somebody said, and to understand that that is some of the fallout of having this kind of openness. And I don't know where that comes from. Maybe that just comes, you know, slowly over time. Tom, I love hearing you. You always have great opinions when it comes to privacy issues. Is that even an issue? Have I made that up in my head to be a problem that, and it's not really a problem?
I think we adapt to this stuff faster than maybe we like to admit. You know, think about people moving from situations where they had fairly private residences, right, into big cities where everyone is packed together. It's, you know, on the grand scheme of things, a fairly recent phenomenon that people live together in such great numbers right next to each other where you can hear everything going on in the room next to you, right? You know generally what your neighbors are up to, at least if they're loud about it. And so that's a different level of privacy that we've gotten used to. If you'd gone to folks who were used to living in sort of a pastoral setting with you know, their residences separated by large amounts of space, and said, you know what we're going to do is we're going to put you all in these apartment buildings and you're going to live right next to each other and you're going to share walls, I think people would freaked out the same way people are freaking out about the different privacy situation on the internet, because they're used to it being a certain way and there's certain things that they want to be private just because they've always been private. But folks adapt, right? And I think some of those things, you know, I don't know what the suburbs of the internet would be. Some people choose to just move away from that and not deal with it, and some people adapt to it.
Yeah, maybe they just don't use it. Maybe that's how they move away. Go ahead, Fraser.
Sorry, I was saying, yeah, Tom's kind of nailed it there, I think, because society will find a way, and the people who are sort of still stuck in the same kind of mannerisms, they might just decide to bail, you know, they won't get involved, you know, hey, I won't post on the internet then, if that's the case. So eventually, if you do want to get involved, you will have to sort of blend in, you know, with the rest of the society as a whole.
Yeah. All right, let's take a quick break and thank our sponsor, Squarespace.com. You've heard us talk about them before. Easy-to-use UI for creating and managing a website or blog. We use them for Forecast. And, Chad, I don't know if you got it. Do you have my screen up? No, we don't? Because what I could do right now, if you could see it, is I could ask Scott on the Forecast website, should the search be on the right or the left, Scott?
Well, normally I'd say, Tom, why do you want to go through so much hard work just to move something from the left to the right?
It's like,
I'd be wrong about that.
It's like four clicks. I go into the architecture of website management. It gives me the layout, and I just drag one across. Like, if I want the search to be on the sidebar too, I just drag it over there. Done. Search is now on the sidebar too. If Scott goes, why'd you move search over there? I want it on the left side up at the top. Boom. I just move it back. It's done. It's that easy. And now I can get in there and edit. Here. You want the search on the right or the left, Scott?
Left.
Okay. I put it on the right. Do you want it on the left?
I'll put it back.
There.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll leave it on the left. Navigation on the right, though? That should be on the left, right?
Yeah, probably on the left.
All right. Let's change that. Now we got a really long left column, so I'm just going to balance it out. I'm going to put this stuff over here. There. And now I just go back here, and it's all saved. I didn't have to press save. I didn't have to do anything like that. I just... and Chrome crashes on me. that's not Squarespace's fault. But see, yeah, it's
there
a thing. Chrome crashes, but look, search is on the left, navigation's on the left. Everything is good. Actually, I put that back over there on the right. But that's as easy as it is. You just drag things right and left, put them where you want them. Squarespace.com is fast and easy, and I love using it. So check them out. Go to Squarespace.com and sign up for a free account. You don't need a credit card or anything. You can sign up right now. Give them a shot. And if you decide to purchase it, use the code FORECAST8. It's FORCAST8. And you'll get 10% off for 6 months. We thank them for their support of Forecast Podcast. And thanks, Chad, for being able to get that screen up. Appreciate that. All right, let's move on to our long-term predictions. And Fraser, we'll stick with you. When you look longer term, maybe more like 100 years, what do you see?
Well, I think scientists have been trying to work with bacteria and bacteria cultures sort of to play with fossil fuels. And I think that technology will kind of get better in time, and we won't actually need to abandon the planet, you know, as many people might fear in the future. You know, we will find a way to recycle what we have and kind of consume the waste that we're producing now. So those systems will get more efficient as cultures evolve. I mean, we generate cultures that can you know, consume that stuff quicker and better, you know, so we won't be making too much waste and we won't have to leave the planet. So
that's good that we don't have to leave the planet for at least another 100 years, because that's been a real concern of some. But I heard somebody was talking about algae-based fossil fuel, and that you would speed up the process. Basically, it's like making a cube of zirconia out of instead of a diamond. It's still a diamond, but since you hurried up the process, it's a lot cheaper. Nobody cares about it because it's not this rare thing that happens naturally in nature. Do you think that this will translate to cheaper fuel costs generally because it'll be so artificial and so quick? We don't have to wait for some dinosaur to decay and, you know, for us to refine the oil thousands of years later, or millions, really. How do you see that?
I think that's the whole point. It will be sort of everything kind of just waste, plastic or any materials that need millions of years to naturally get broken down could be done faster, you know, with these bacteria. So you just kind of farm these out, put your stuff in there, and it just, you know, in a week's turnaround or something, you have a fresh flow of all oils and anything, gases, kind of natural gases and anything we might need. So we're kind of getting rid of nature in a sense and kind of taking it under our own control. So that technology will help us solve today's problems, really.
So you'll be able to burn oil without emitting carbon dioxide, possibly?
That would be a plus.
I like, Scott, your idea, too. Would it become a status symbol to burn real gas instead of the synthetic gas?
Well, that's kind of what I was kind of getting at. And I wonder if also we might see spring up, because my daughter, the first thing she said when we were talking about this around the dinner table, we were talking about fossil fuel and about algae and about, you know, microbes and stuff like this. And she says, well, then aren't you killing life to make gas? Because she's a hippie and she loves that, you know, she doesn't want to see the chicken I'm eating on my table just disgusts her. She can't stand it when animals or any kind of living creature has to suffer. And so we always have these interesting conversations about all of that. My guess is we'll see some of that spring up. There's always going to be some reason somebody somewhere is going to hate this idea. It's going to have some other impact we can't think of right now. But as a whole, what I read and what I hear about where we are with this technology today and what it could potentially do, I think it's awesome. The worry I have is that the current day establishment does not let it out of the gate. And that's very conspiratorial of me, and that's very, you know, spy movie of me, but I just see major big oil and big government and everybody else kind of kiboshing this before it happens too soon. Now, maybe 100 years is enough for us to stretch that out, but that needs to be a nice gradual slow burn. And I feel like we need it sooner than that. So that remains my concern. Teresa, do you think government and big money are going to let us change the way we consume oil in this cleaner, better, faster way?
I hope so. I mean, I hope that someday that we can, you know, avoid all these crazy political type issues when it really comes down to our ability to continue living the way that we do live. Can I just say, though, that no joke, that Fraser's prediction is very, very similar to my crazy prediction, where I talked about how there would be no such thing as garbage in the future, and that everything will be reused and repurposed and transformed, so that, you know, we'll finally figure out how to have like a net zero production process. And I was just thinking, like, I want to see a Mr. Fusion, like a Back to the Future Mr. Fusion created that everyone has in their house, so that whenever you're making whatever, like making your food, you've got waste, you've got package waste, all that stuff. We figured out a way to break it down and transform it into a great source of renewable energy, because even though there's no, like, we're not going to call it garbage, we really are producing waste no matter what we do. So, you know, it was very interesting.
Fraser, what do you think? I mean, should this be a crazy prediction? Or you seem to think it's long term, but it's achievable.
I have a crazy prediction at hand, so yeah, in 100 years we can handle that.
Just to clarify, I was thinking it's crazy because I'm a little doubtful that it would happen in 100 years, but maybe we could extend it to be like 500, and hopefully that will be the future.
It's weird to me that we haven't just figured out a way to melt stuff down and burn it again. And I know that isn't simple, and I know that I'm just
Well, we have figured out how to melt stuff down and burn it, just not to get an appreciable amount of energy out of it.
Right. And I guess that's the part I'm talking about.
I used to get in trouble from my dad because I'd take trash and burn it in the fireplace just, you know, because I wanted to watch the milk carton melt because it was cool looking. And he's like, you can't do that. It emits weird stuff, and it's bad for the fireplace, and stop. It's just garbage.
You'll get black lung and all that sort of thing. Yeah. We couldn't burn styrofoam plates at camp for the same reason. We always scoutmasters are like, everyone will die and we'll kill the earth if you burn those things. But I don't know. I just feel like this should be closer than 100 years from now. I feel like we've been on the cusp of this for too long. And I hope Fraser's prediction comes true in the next 10. Can we do that? That'd be great.
All right. Well, Teresa, we need to get your long-term prediction then.
Yeah.
So when you look more in the flying car sort of direction, what do you see?
So what I was seeing is the evolution of what I kind of call sort of an immersive media, where you're sort of fully embedded in the experience of communication. And we're kind of seeing that starting out now. But I think that in 100 years, we're going to see, like, the full embedding of people into, you know, movies. It's like virtual reality, but kind of even more than that, where you're actually, you know, you're smelling the things that are happening, you're tasting the air, and you're in this whole new place where communication is transformed into your experience. And I think that's going to be sort of the key thing for how we're going to start to learn about the world. Education in the future, I think, will be based on this type of model, where we're going to send the kids and have them be fully immersed in this new kind of world, where because they won't have the chance to be out there learning about it firsthand. Maybe those things don't exist anymore. We're putting them in the situation. We're giving them that sort of firsthand experience, but it's not really firsthand. It's mediated, but it's very immersive, very much like being there. And that's what I thought would be exciting in 100 years.
So, just correct me if I'm wrong, but this maybe presents opportunities for people to. I mean, I'm trying to think of an
holodeck?
Example.
If
I, Holodesk, great idea. Actually, it's a great concept of how this would be. Because right now, it's go and sit in an auditorium and look at a PowerPoint, listen to a dude, and then go home. And I would love, as much as, you know, Star Trek got weird with the holodeck sometimes, I would love the idea of being able to go and experience the thing I'm meant to be learning, to smell what it was like to be on the front lines in this particular battle in World War II, and to know what that looked like and felt like. That would be amazing. I probably don't want to, but you know what I mean? I mean, a true education would be, wow, war is hell. This was terrible. Look what these guys did. They're super heroic. Those guys are jerks, you know, whatever, and really walk away with a sense of time, place, and all that that you normally don't get from a lecture or a lesson. I like this idea a lot.
Yeah, I like it too. Fraser, what do you think? Do you want the holodeck experience, as Teresa is describing it, the sort of immersive ability? Well, you said it's immersive media, so it's not just movies or TV shows. It can be anything.
It's that, definitely. I mean, smell vision, we're bringing that back. So... It's a whole full experience where you can learn, you know, everything. So just plugged in maybe straight to your brain, and you know that's a way. I was thinking maybe taking it even further. It could be a way to actually even. That's how people fight wars in the future, or even go to school. Then and, you know, you just do it all from home, or just plug yourself in and you log into this universe. Or, you know, or an experience, a game, or driving simulation, skydiving, if you don't want to actually go out and do it. So that makes sense to get all these range of experiences, you know. If maybe there's a historical landmark that was destroyed 100 years ago, you could go and visit it and watch a museum or something. Maybe that could fix our writing problem, so...
So Teresa, if I'm... Let's say this, because here's the problem with the holodeck and all these other kind of ideas. People are going to abuse them. They're not going to get used. Like the Deep Space Nine usage of the holodeck was a lot more realistic, I think.
They kind of used it as...
Yeah, it was more... Well, there was some of that, but also in Quark's Bar, he was using it for, you know, this little pleasure palace thing that everybody would come and use. And I got to thinking, that's probably how these things are going to get used and abused. And higher learning and higher experience and all of this doesn't seem like it'll be the thing that will motivate people. Is there anything about this prediction that you could say would be the defining, the thing about it that would be the most compelling as an educational experience or a learning experience rather than just an escapism or a place to go and meet fake girls or whatever?
I think the most compelling piece for this, at least in my mind, would be the idea that, I guess, kind of take a step back and just think about what people are experiencing now and the experience of education as it is, and things that maybe you got to experience that your kids didn't have the chance. So, for example, like learning about plants and animals that maybe don't exist anymore, and like what Fraser was saying, going to visit those old places where there's really important learnings to achieve just by really being there. I don't know. I guess it's not a fully thought out prediction, but, you know, I think that it could be just the idea of being there when otherwise you would never have been able to could be a huge learning component. And I think even specifically for like environmental education, where you get to experience what it's like to play outside or be in the jungle, or even just like climb a tree when, let's say, you live in a city and there aren't any trees to climb. This could be like a great way of getting people to develop relationships with, you know, nature or what have you, and sort of develop that bond so that they can keep those things to be important to their hearts and make everything nice and pretty and green in the future.
Well, probably, I mean, it'd probably do two things. Like, if you pulled them into war scenarios, that would probably help deter people from going to war in the first place. If you could relive those, you know, those horrors and be in Vietnam and feel it and be there and all that, even the sensation of being shot or something and having to go to a medevac or something, whatever, all of those kinds of experiences would probably teach us that, man, that's a terrible thing. And even though I'm so many generations removed from that, I can still learn from what should have been learned, and that's that this is a terrible conflict. And then maybe you'll learn from other wars that, okay, well, this one, as horrible as it is, this was done for these five reasons, and they turn out to be very noble reasons or reasons that needed to happen or whatever. And you could argue World War II had some of that going for it and others, but I think that would be good. But also, on the other hand, it would maybe encourage us to be more in touch with things that, let's say, trees disappear in 100 years. They're just gone. We've used them up. We're living underground now. And all we have left is this weird holodeck that we can then go back and sort of appreciate the extinct trees. That seemed like a great way to stay, I guess, connected to who we once were.
Of course, it could also be used for ill, right? I mean, it could be used to convince people that something that is a good idea is bad because you change, you know, you're in control of the reality in something like this. So, you know, you can immerse people in a lie, so to speak.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, and the thing that came to mind when I was coming up with sort of this thing was the Matrix and how that kind of went bad in some ways.
And we could be there right now.
We could be. This is all a dream.
There's a 20% chance you're living in a simulation. It actually has been determined statistically.
20%?
Yeah.
Wow. I don't like those odds at all, Tom. That makes me nervous.
I know. Well, there's an 80% chance you're not.
Oh, all right.
Think of it that way.
Well, when you put it that
much
way.
Better.
Yeah. Well, now, Teresa, you kind of gave us your crazy-ass prediction.
Well, I did have a backup.
Okay, yeah. Let's hear your backup.
So my backup one, and I'm all for, like, I love sort of the whimsical part of history and sort of legend and mythology. So my crazy prediction, crazy, is that all of the sort of little creatures like fairies and dwarves and these types of sort of mythological creatures do still exist. They're in hiding, and in 1,000 or 2,000 years, when we're all gone, they all come back.
Wow, planet of the fairies and wood.
Well, we turn ourselves into plants, and they probably just eat us.
Right.
Yeah.
I knew that one was going to come back, but I didn't quite know how. That's a great connection. But so really, this, the whole fantasy realm, are we talking dragons and all sorts of mystical creatures, like dudes with a horse for a body and a dude for a, for a head or whatever. What are those called?
Centaurs.
Anyway. Centaurs. Are we going to see all that stuff come back?
I was really thinking more of the smaller ones that could easily be hidden, that could maybe be invisible. Sometimes they have little magical type powers of sort of disappearing quickly without you noticing. Kind of like when you're in a forest and you think someone's watching you, but you're sure that no one's there. That sort of feeling. I think that it's kind of still happens to me anyways when I'm in the forest or if I'm walking through a path and sometimes you just kind of get that that feeling. So why is it? I mean, we don't really know for sure, do we?
Well, no, biologically speaking, supposedly that is just your defense mechanism to kind of overinterpret being watched. So if there is a predator after you, you'll catch on to it. That doesn't mean they're not watching.
No, that's true. But I was going for a more magical feeling there. There was some whimsy happening.
Or it could be there's just a
Fraser,
lot of people.
Fraser, what's your take on the future of fantasy creatures back in our lives?
I think that anything is possible in that scenario. I mean,
it was crazy.
I think Fraser knows more about this than he's letting on.
Yeah,
that is blowing my mind. I feel like I'm being watched right now. To be honest.
You are by about 730 people.
Well, the cool thing about, and no spoilers here, and I don't even mean to really bring this up, but in this new Planet of the Apes movie, which plenty of people have seen and many of haven't, so again, no spoilers,
there's
the theory about man's downfall and the actual rise of the apes is really cool. I like the take they took. And Tom, I know you've seen it, but I'll just say this. There's no reason why that same sort of scenario couldn't work in the fairies are coming out of the woods scenario.
And I know I kind of have the same idea as Teresa. When you say it, and that's why she's being very careful to say this is crazy, people are like, oh, yeah, the fairies are coming. Uh-huh. But I think if you think about it, there may be other animals or even sentient creatures that are good at hiding and we might not have been able to detect yet. That could explain a lot of things like extraterrestrial visitations. I'm not saying that's likely. That's why it's crazy ass prediction. But, I think that makes a good story is that, we do have areas of the world deep in the ocean, deep in the forest that are unexplored still. We kind of think, oh, we've watched, we've gone up into space. We've seen everything. But, there are corners of the world where there might be some unknown things there. So who knows?
Yeah, there's a hill full of ants in my backyard. When I walk past it, over it, or near it, has no idea that I'm there, that I exist, that I represent a threat. They have no idea. No idea at all.
Oh, they know.
So I always wonder, what is around me somewhere that is huge, and I just look, I don't even see it, because I'm an ant on my hill. I just have a more advanced hill than the ants in my backyard. And that thought never quite leaves me. I always think about that.
Fraser, mm-hmm. What's your crazy-ass prediction when you look really far out there? Will we all be made of cheese someday?
I wish we were, but mine is pretty much, some scientists have been talking about evolution sort of slowing down, but I think we're actually making it speed up in a sense that, we don't need natural selection, mutation, or kind of random change to take place anymore. We actually affect it ourselves directly. So in a million years or whatever, we would just become something completely different. The graph will just literally become exponential at how fast we're actually changing. We're not seeing the effects now, but they are actually happening. Diseases that needed like generations to get eradicated through that natural selection, healable in 10 years. So stuff like that makes us more survival. So survival, it gives us a more chance of survival and just enhances us. We're living longer. We're just getting more efficient at doing everything. So later on, we'll probably be super humans, super people.
Or centaurs.
Yeah, or centaurs.
That could actually explain what happens. We just evolve into them.
Yeah, man on top, horse on bottom. I'm telling you, though. So, okay, let's say it's speeding up. How much is it speeding up? In other words, if right now it takes me, 10 years of or 10 million years of natural selection to grow a tail, what in your compression rate, how quickly will I have a tail in a million years?
Or in your case, lose a tail.
Right.
As humans have lost our tails.
my vestigial tail. When does that leave? No, but I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, if the time's really compressed, yeah. How much is it compressed? How quick will we see the changes?
I mean, I was thinking more when cell phones started popping up, people were saying, everyone's going to develop bigger thumbs. But I feel like that wasn't necessary. We've sort of skipped that already. So natural selection didn't even need to worry about that. We've kind of moved on to the next thing. So we sort of just keep, we're going through these paces faster than we needed to sort of sit down and absorb them and figure them out. We don't need to take ages to, you know, natural selection doesn't need to take ages to figure it out. We just kind of keep moving on to the next thing. So I just think some sort of exponential increase, you know, speeding up, because we test it out, we figure it out. We either implement it or we shun it, but it's happening just a quicker refresh cycle, really.
My sister has a theory she talks about all the time about how we are driven, human beings are typically driven by survival. And because we live in a time and in societies today where on the large part, we're not constantly facing death from a bear or some other animal or a warring tribe. Sure, these things happen in wars and, you know, certain parts of the world. But for the most part, we are no longer under that constant threat from other creatures. And so we're not constantly having to do our fight and flight. And because of that, a lot of us sort of settle into a nervous that something's going to happen, but we don't know what kind of routine. And she thinks that the bigger impact on evolution that we'll have if our society is to continue the way that they're continuing is the lack of a threat to us. To most of us personally will eventually result in major changes in our humanity. Teresa, does that ring true to you at all? How do you see the future of human evolution?
Yeah, I think that last piece where we don't have to worry as much sort of creates this sense of complacency. I don't know, you just kind of get lazy about it, and that could have some really interesting, maybe detrimental impacts on how we as a society, as a being exist. The other thing that I was thinking about was that, you know, because of the what Fraser was saying, how we, you know, cell phones, they didn't really last long enough for natural selection to, you know, improve the human body to make it more effective. I thought about the things that there's not really anything right now that's fixed. Like, there's nothing really other than our behaviors that last a long time. So like the fact that we sit at a desk and maybe work sitting down for most of the day, and for most people, you know, that could be have an impact on what we're going to turn into. Like, maybe we'll lose the ability to kind of walk around, or I don't know, like it could go crazy. Well, yeah, sort of be waddling everywhere. I don't know.
It's the lack of a selection. There's, you know, evolution works by selection pressure. Anything that gives you a survival advantage tends to, you know, propagate in the species. But then there's the removal of a selection pressure, which can allow for diversification. I mean, the fact that we don't have bears chasing us anymore might allow things to flower in the human condition that couldn't have in the past, right? You know, like, if you have three legs, you don't run as fast, so we get two legs because that's optimal for running, maybe. I don't even know if that's true, but just as an example. So maybe without having anything chasing us, all of a sudden we just start getting weirder.
Yeah, it has to be something that has a longer sustainable period of time that it's present in our lives. And that goes to my sister's theory that it will be this lack of a threat is just going to change our physiology and the way we think with our minds. I don't mean that we're going to get lazy and that. She actually thinks that we're still built to be, you know, jumpy and freak out and defend ourselves, but that will force some other weird mutations.
And or maybe nervous people will do stupid things because they're nervous, or they'll jump out of airplanes and looking for thrills, and they'll all die, and the really calm people survive, and then the aliens come and wipe us all out because we're too calm.
Yeah, then they're too calm. So exactly, we're right back to where we started. But it is interesting to think that something like cell phones come and they go, and ways we communicate come and go. And unless one of these things that comes and then stays, it has to stay for a really, really long time, more than thousands of years, to have natural selection kick in and go, all right, well, that's had an impact on who survives and who doesn't. And until then, I just don't know what that is. I like her theory, but I don't, you know, it may not hold water either. So I don't know what that thing is. But the idea that
if we speed up evolution, like Fraser's talking about, it doesn't take as much time. It's because it's generations.
Right.
You need number of generations. You can evolve things very fast in bacteria because they generate. They go through generations so fast.
Yeah, and they talk about you know, you take 10 generations of a fox and turn it into a docile house animal, from wild fox to docile house animal, because they forced the selection by only pulling out the ones that were quiet and sweet and putting them together and making more puppies and then doing the same thing 10 times over. Suddenly you've evolved an animal in a very short amount of time compared to what it would have to happen naturally. And I just don't know what else I don't know what we have in humanity that we can force that way unless we do some terrible, terrible thing.
Second nose.
I feel like we have a bigger input to all of this because, we can kind of genetically modify ourselves, and that actually helps push it forward as well. Because maybe in the future you have enhanced athletes, like swimmers might have to get webbed, you know, webbed fingers and toes, just because that's the way to compete nowadays. You know, so stuff like that could just make it a more extreme sport, just because we have the technology to do that. So you know, just the population might just evolve into other things because we can decide to have that in the genes. So since we're already learning how to kind of read the code of the gene, you know, we're trying to depict aging and things like that. So if we have more input to that kind of growth and change, you know, we will speed up the filter. We won't need natural selection to kick in, really, because we'll be pushing it ourselves. Sort of thing.
We'll be selecting. It'll be unnatural selection.
Yeah, unnatural selection.
Right. All right, before we get to four questions, I want to thank our other sponsor for today's show, netflix.com/twit. If you ever watch Scott Johnson's show Film Sack, you're going to need Netflix to get the most out of it. You can still listen to it and have a great time, but if you really want to like squeeze every last drop out of what Scott does, you need Netflix. Netflix.com/twit will help you enjoy your life more.
I could tell you how bad Life Force is, 1985's Life Force, but it's going to be so much better for you to see how bad that movie is on your own.
So get it. Try it for free for 30 days. You can stream TV and movie shows right to your television, to your laptop, to your phone, to your tablet, any situation you can think of. You can be watching a TV or a movie as long as you have the internet connection and as long as you have Netflix. Netflix.com/twit. Try it for 30 days free. We thank them for their support of Forecast. It's time for four questions, Scott.
Four questions is where we ask our guests four questions, rapid fire style, and we ask them quickly so they do not have time to answer. They can only answer from the gut. Well, they have time to answer, but they have to answer quickly. I am going to be asking my questions today of Fraser. Fraser, are you sitting comfortably?
I hope so.
All right, excellent. If you had your own holodeck, what would be the first thing you'd do in there?
I would want a simulation of Jurassic Park. I can play on the dinosaurs.
Nice.
Delete
Raptors. Oh, you'd
raptors,
be on the dinosaurs. That's cool.
DEL Raptors before you go in.
Yeah, make sure you got all the safety stuff in place. If you get too close, I'm sorry. If you get to choose, where would you like your RFID implant implanted?
It's going to have to be in the back of my neck.
All right.
Just below its skull.
That's a very sci-fi place for it. I want to put mine where it's embarrassing for an agent of mischief to find it. Gum that never loses its flavor or artificial steak? It's a hard
one. It's going to have to be it's going to have to be the artificial steak.
I'm with you there.
I was going to give you one. A third choice could have been gum that tastes like steak that never loses its flavor. Finally, where will sentient machines first spring from? Automated vacuums, your phone, or something else entirely?
They're basically going to show up out of vehicles, I think. And after watching Transformers, I think that's where they're coming from.
All right. I like that idea.
Cars. Yeah.
Hopefully they're all Autobots. Congratulations. You have succeeded in four questions. Tom, I turn it over to you, sir.
All right. Teresa, are you sitting comfortably?
Sure am.
Good. Then we'll begin. Question number one. Will we ever become a cashless society, and how will that work?
Oh, yeah, I think we will. I think it'll work on some kind of, like, I guess if it's cashless, does it mean creditless? I don't know. But if it's completely cashless, like no paper money or anything, I think it would just be like return to some kind of weird barter system. But it'd be like information or brain power that you would trade. I don't know.
Like Woofy or something like that, yeah. Question number two, what social network will kill Facebook after it gets done, or I'm sorry, what social network will kill Google Plus after it gets done killing Facebook?
Gosh, I don't know. I don't think it's probably not created yet, but it'll be something where we can really immerse into the experience of sharing.
Just make up a name. What do you think it'd be called?
Oh, it's called,
how do you spell Gai?
Yeah, it's called Gai. Yeah, there you go. G-A-I-E.
You know what? It sounds silly, but you may not be far wrong. Woo-hoo. Question number three, Stargate. When do we discover it? Or do we?
I'm going to go with another, like, 75 years or so.
All right.
They're still discovering those, like, ancient Egypt, like, not the ruins, not in Egypt, but, like, in the jungle and stuff. It could be in there.
All right. Fair enough. I'll be gone, but I'm glad somebody gets to see it. And question number four, what planet will be the most popular tourist destination and why?
I'm going to go with Jupiter, just because it's got that's the gassy one, right?
Yeah, great red spot.
Yeah. Just because it's got all
that's
those,
what
like,
makes it popular. It's the gassy
there you
one.
Go. Yes, that's no. I was gonna say it's because it's all the colors. It's pretty, yeah, and the people right will experience it in that way.
Something different, and it's huge.
That too.
All right, you have completed four questions. Thank you.
Good.
And that completes our show, Scott Johnson. Can you believe it? We're done with yet another episode of Forecast.
Amazing, amazing. Great work by everybody. You guys were awesome as guests. And we don't ever do this very much, but behind the boards today, OMG Chad, knocking it out of the park. Thanks,
well,
man, for
done,
all
the help. Che-Jo.
Yeah.
I'm trying to give him a nickname, but it's just not working.
Che-Jo.
All right. Well, thank our guest, Fraser Ntakula. Thanks for being on Forecast. Let folks know what you do, where they can find out about it.
I'm an animator and motion designer, so I make stuff move, basically. You can find me at FraserNtakula.com, and the same thing for Twitter, please. Yeah, so.
FraserNtakula for Fraser, yeah. And then NTUKULA.com.
That's me.
Excellent. And Teresa, great to see you again. Thanks for being on the show, and let folks know what you're up to and where they can find your stuff on the net.
Well, I'm up to all kinds of crazy things, and you can find me on Twitter at Teresa Dawn Ellis, D-A-W-N, and also on Google Plus. And I just wanted to say that I was really happy that I could use my iPad for this. I heard this was a first for your show.
I didn't realize you're on Skype on iPad.
That's right.
I would have never
went really
known.
Well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Awesome.
Yeah, it works really well. All right. Well, thanks for blazing a trail for us.
Got my geek cred.
Appreciate that. Scott, any last words before we go?
No, I did something cool. If people want to see my Google Plus profile, I made a link for them that's easy. It's at frogpants.com/plus. It's totally cool. You just go there and boom, you're in my profile in the Google Plus.
Now,
so people
should
try that.
Did you do
out
a JavaScript redirect to get that?
I did not. I did a basic HTML redirect.
Just a regular
that is
old.
As old as the web itself. That file is maybe 1K.
Wow.
It's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so check out frogpants.com/plus. Was that right?
Yeah, that's it. /plus.
And don't forget to leave comments at our website, forecastpodcast.com, or send us an email, forecastpodcast@gmail.com. Till next time, we'll see ya.
Bye.
But it's only 32 years away.
Way.
So we have two competing titles, corn porn or the gassy one?
I like the gassy one. I think the gassy one's pretty good.
Corn porn just really makes me visualize horrible things.
We can combine them, corn porn with the gassy one.
Yeah, it could go very wrong with the corn title.